in the end, if we manage to get to a sustainable plan, we will all be elated and no one will be really happy.
The legislative minority proposes a new committee to vet budget proposals. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage soldiers weigh in on the Bo Bergdahl case and the latest season of Serial.
There's some disdain. People listen to it with hatred. For me, it's just more information and more closure.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner introduced legislation yesterday to create a permanent Ways and Means Committee in the Senate. It's a companion to a bill introduced by Representative Scott Kawasaki, a Democrat from Fairbanks, in the House earlier this week. I spoke with Gardner as part of a series of conversations with legislative leaders this week. She says the committee would provide a forum where legislators can understand the costs and the benefits of any proposal to address the budget deficit.
Whether they're new revenue, taxes, or cuts, because I think a lot of us lack the information to really make informed votes. And the Finance Committee, where normally this kind of discussion goes, is already overwhelmed. I mean, almost every bill goes through there and things get bottlenecked. And it also, the finance committees are not a forum for all legislators to participate. And we would like to broaden that discussion so that the Ways and Means Committee could focus exclusively on new revenue and cuts, and more people can be actively engaged in asking questions and studying the issues.
Well, lawmakers have a lot of work this session in a short amount of time. Is there any concern that adding a committee might make the process more cumbersome?
Well, not necessarily, because our primary obligation in this session clearly is this issue. And if it means we can't get to other things in other committees, well, so be it. I mean, there is nothing more important, more urgent in this unprecedented situation in which we find ourselves. We hear people comparing it to what happened in the 80s. It's nothing like the 80s. In the 80s, all that oil was still in the ground, and access to it was right on the horizon. That's not the case now. It's a deep, deep hole. And the best we can do in terms of new revenue from our resources is a drop in the bucket, if you pardon that expression, compared to what we need in a $3.5 or $4 billion hole that we're in.
Last year's session was contentious. Are you hopeful Democrats, Republicans, and the governor can have a better working relationship this year?
I am. I think everybody learned a lot. The majority Republicans on the House side, I think, were particularly in a tough place because they weren't used to having to negotiate with the minority and kind of didn't know how. We have a new governor who was getting his feet under him, and he had very little history in this building. So things have been a little awkward and inefficient, and people stepped on each other's toes at times, and I don't think there was any malice or anything intended. But things, you know, we're all learning how to deal with each other and work with each other. Beyond that, I am greatly bolstered by the way the special session in October went. And I've been through a lot of special sessions, and that is the first time I felt that people came down not locked into place. I mean, it was a really good process, and people came together, and in the end, it was, you know, overwhelming support. So I like that, and it shows me that we can work together and let go of things when we want to or need to or see a good reason to, and there's never a better reason than what we're looking at right now.
Will you support tapping the permanent fund earnings?
I don't want to say that I would never do that, but everything has to be part of a package. Under what conditions? You know, this will be a discussion that we all have to have. And I understand, according to the Rasmussen Foundation poll, there's broad support for doing that in the public. But doing that and what? To what end? I mean, do we have a sustainable thing? Once we start getting into using the fund itself, it's almost like a license to keep going, and we have to make other hard decisions.
Are there taxes that you would support or could support?
I think that in the end, if we manage to get to a sustainable plan, we will all be elated and no one will be really happy. And that's true for all of us. And it's just going to be a long process. I think we need to be talking with each other and willing to listen and willing to consider what other people want to.
Berta Gardner is Senate Minority Leader. Governor Bill Walker called for the legislature to work together with him to close the state's budget shortfall. The annual State of the State address last night reflected the state's grave budget situation. Walker said the budget crisis was a long time coming. He said the state has had a hole in what he called its fiscal boat since oil production began to drop in the 1980s.
As governor, I am flexible on the details of a fiscal plan, as long as the outcome meets the basic tests of fairness and sustainability. I am not flexible on the need to get there this year. It's time to fix the hole in the boat.
Walker has proposed reducing the annual permanent fund dividend, and he would also introduce a new personal income tax and raise other taxes while cutting spending. The state is seeking to close a $3.5 billion budget shortfall. After the address, politicians from both parties expressed a willingness to work with the governor. Senator John Coghill said fellow Republicans agreed with much of what Walker said, but his party is looking for deeper spending cuts, and Coghill suggested that while there may be progress, the legislature is unlikely to close the entire shortfall this year.
Some of the details that he has put forward are going to be tougher to shuffle together than as alluded to in the speech.
The speech came near the end of the first week of the legislative session. Last year, the legislature ran well past their 90-day deadline to adopt a budget. A federal agency is calling for more research into large-scale mortality of common MERS and other seabirds off Alaska's coast. The National Wildlife Health Center, an arm of the U.S. Geological Survey that assesses the impact of disease on wildlife, today issued a wildlife bulletin on the deaths of common MERS over the last 11 months. MER carcasses from the dozens to thousands have been found on beaches from the Alaska Panhandle to the East Aleutian Islands. The bulletin notes large floating aggregations of lethargic MERS in Prince William Sound that are exhibiting minimal avoidance behavior. Testing of carcasses has found most dead birds to be emaciated. The bulletin says more research is needed to determine whether unprecedented warm ocean temperatures may be affecting seabird prey. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a trip to a unique wildlife sanctuary north of Haines.
I'm going to talk in a very strange way, so don't think I'm crazy. It's just the way I communicate.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Interior Department has proposed new rules restricting methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, and oil and gas production is a significant source. The Obama administration has set a target for reducing methane emissions from the industry by 45% within a decade. The proposed new rules won't have much impact in Alaska. They apply to operations on federal land, while the vast majority of drilling here takes place on state land. And Kathy Forrester of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says the state already has this issue under control.
Every month, every operator has to account to my agency for every puff of gas they produce.
Forrester says methane emissions total about 0.5% of the natural gas produced in the state. Still, she says, it adds up.
At Prudhoe Bay, they produce 8 BCF a day. So less than 0.5% of a big number is a big number.
Meanwhile, Alaska officials would like the federal government to clean up its own act. Interior still hasn't dealt with the so-called legacy wells drilled on federal land decades ago, including one that has been leaking methane for years.
My agency and the Alaska legislature have had a concerted effort to force the Department of Interior to hold itself to the same standards that it holds industry to.
That may finally be happening. In 2013, Senator Lisa Murkowski secured funding to deal with some of the legacy wells. Forrester says the Bureau of Land Management expects to deal with a leaking well this year or next. Senator Murkowski today announced a slew of staff changes. Current and former employees say the timing of the multiple departures is merely coincidental, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the change begins at the top.
For those of you keeping score at home, sharpen your pencils. Michael Pawlowski will take over as Murkowski's chief of staff. Pawlowski, better known in Alaska as Fish, has been working for Murkowski in Washington for a little more than a year. He's a former Alaska legislative aide and was deputy commissioner of revenue in the Parnell administration. Current chief of staff Ed Hild is leaving after more than 20 years of work in the Senate. Murkowski is promoting longtime aide Nathan Burgerbest to deputy chief of staff. Also, Garrett Boyle, a relatively new staffer who grew up in rural Alaska, is the new legislative director. Former ledge director Kate Williams, originally from Juneau, has gone to work in the office of the Senate Republican whip. Still with me? There's more. Robert Dillon, Murkowski's communications director on the Senate Energy Committee, is also leaving the Senate after 7 years.
It was really hard yesterday walking out of the office for the last time, and I've said multiple times that it's not a job, it's family.
Dillon says he knows of no shared reason for the staff departures. In his case, he says opportunity called from the private sector.
Well, I will be heading up the D.C. office of Strategy 360, a public policy firm based in Seattle, but has offices, of course, in Anchorage and in 10 states across the West.
Dillon, a former reporter for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and other publications, says he'll continue to work on Alaska issues in his new job. Meanwhile, Karina Peterson has been promoted to Communications Director of Murkowski's Senate office. Peterson was raised in Soldotna and is a former KTVA reporter. She replaces Matthew Felling, who left Murkowski's office last fall and now works for Hill & Knowlton, a communications strategy firm. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska soldiers are weighing in on the Bo Bergdahl case. Bergdahl was an Army infantryman who was part of a unit within the 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division, stationed at Fort Richardson when he walked away from his post in Afghanistan in 2009. The case has drawn national attention and is even the focus of Season 2 of Serial, a wildly popular podcast. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, what soldiers are saying about the case and the podcast depends on who you ask.
If you're like me, this music makes you salivate. But if you're a member of the 501st Infantry's Blackfoot Company, in the summer of 2009 when Bergdahl went missing, it's hit or miss whether the music strikes a chord.
I just started listening to Serial because it was recommended by no less than five people that I trust that served with me.
Nick Tabachka was a staff sergeant when he retired from the Army in 2013. He knew Bergdahl. They were part of the same company when Bergdahl went missing, and Tabachka was actually the person who took both of the widely circulated photos of the then private first class. He and some other soldiers that were in at the same time as Bergdahl are paying close attention to the podcast.
I think why I like it is because I recognize a lot of those voices. And so when you know these people, it's actually a good report. And I'm not even a NPR or public radio aficionado. Really, I'm not.
Tabachka was one of three speakers at a University of Alaska Anchorage panel sponsored by the Political Science Association, a nonpartisan student group. Though many facts in the case are still unclear, there's no dispute over this. Bergdahl left his post, resulting in his capture by the Taliban and setting in motion an enormous manhunt across Afghanistan. Tabachka says that when he started hearing rumors that if Bergdahl were rescued from years of imprisonment, he likely wouldn't be tried, it made him furious.
And as an NCO at the time, and somebody who categorizes myself as a company man, I was always a fan of, you know, being fair and impartial when recommending both punishments and awards. So I'm thinking to myself, this is the worst thing that I've ever seen, and yet we're not going to pursue this to the fullest extent of the law.
In December, the Army announced it would be court-martialing Bergdahl over the desertion charge. And for Tabachka, the company man, it had the effect of the company recognizing its own rules, making good on what he'd understood was fair.
A lot of us are still trying to find closure, but what we've been trying to understand for almost 7 years, which is, why would you do that? Like, what was running through your mind? Serial has actually allowed us to do that because we're hearing excerpts from his own quotations. And so... there's some disdain. People listen to it with hatred. For me, it's just more information and more closure.
One of the people who referred Tabachka to Serial is a first lieutenant named Ryan Morrell, who got to Afghanistan just as the search for Bergdahl was escalating.
I do like the Serial podcast. It reminds me of This American Life, which is also a favorite show of mine.
Morrell thinks that some of host Sarah Koenig's insights are very civilian-esque, but he says that the reporting does a good job of establishing the scale of bewilderment and betrayal felt by soldiers, which is something civilians can have a hard time appreciating when the topic of desertion comes up.
We've never really seen this before, at least not in the 20th century and not in this war. And to do such a sinful act, such a betrayal to your brothers, we have trouble conceptualizing it, fathoming that. It's so, why would you conduct such a heinous act?
The Bergdahl court-martial case is set for August of 2016. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Martin Boozer has been dropped to last place and without prize money for this year's Kuskokwim 300. The race committee made the decision yesterday after reviewing evidence of Boozer committing two penalties, leaving the trail and receiving help to feed his dogs. K300 board chairman and race co-founder Myron Angstman says the board has steered away from giving penalties for most of the race's history, even letting minor infractions go without comment. But Angstman says with the race's growing status, the rules are tightening.
The purse is getting bigger, the attention to the race is getting bigger, and the precedent would be, yes, we do take rule violations seriously, and especially in a situation like this where it impacts safety.
According to the race committee, Boozer left the trail inbound to Kalskag and did not return to the marked route even after a race representative intercepted him and told him to return to the trail or be disqualified. In an email to KYUK and the race committee, Boozer says he was following the markers when he got lost and started mushing through what he called scary-looking watery ice on a busted sled. When the race officials met him and told him to go back to the marked trail, he said he had already tried to find it. Ultimately, the race committee docked Boozer from 14th place with $3,700 to last place with no money. Boozer says he won't return to the K300 as a competitor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Zachariah Hughes. This week on AK, Wild Sanctuary. About 30 miles north of Haines, there's a sanctuary for abandoned wildlife, big and small. Steve Crochell has owned and operated Crochell's Wildlife Center for decades. He's been dubbed the Wildlife Whisperer. Even wolverines, those compact killing machines capable of handily taking down an adult moose, play with Crochell like he's one of the pack. KHNS's Jillian Rogers visited the unique ranch earlier this winter and found out that there is a method to the madness.
My first encounter with Crochell is memorable. I hear his nasally, high-pitched calls long before I see him. It kind of sounds like someone strangling a cat, no offense to cat lovers. And then he comes into sight.
Come on!
Oh my God, it's a wolverine.
Good morning!
Good morning!
Well, I'll be right there.
Okay.
I'm bringing a wolverine with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's obvious right away that Crochell, who's 55, has a strong connection to these wild beasts. It's a wolverine on a leash, for Pete's sake. It's also obvious that he's hosted this tour a million times. He grew up on a large farm and has always had a fondness for all things furry and four-legged.
I'm going to talk in a very strange way, so don't think I'm crazy. It's just the way I communicate.
Ha! Ha ha! Ha ha ha! Ha ha! This is Bamp.
The Carhartt-clad Crochell explains that not all of the 50 or so animals here are rescues. Some are born at the center. And the animals he's raised develop a strong bond with him from birth. They imprint, he says. Crochell is permitted to the gills by the state so he can house, handle, and breed his animals. There are moose, bears, lynx, reindeer, mink, ermine, and of course, wolverines, all on his 52-acre parcel. He says he's facilitated 6 litters of wolverines in 30 years, but is now just down to 2 males, including Banff. He hosts busloads of tourists each summer, a way to help pay for the critters and introduce visitors to his unconventional lifestyle. Last year, he hosted 125 tour groups. Crochell touts himself as a naturalist and a filmmaker. He walks around barefoot in the non-snowy months to better connect with the earth. He has help with the caretaking. His son and volunteers assist in feeding and other tasks. Banff eventually settles into play mode with Crochell. I'm still cautioned to keep my distance. Every few minutes, Crochell lets out a yowl when the wolverine gets a little too rough.
Oh! Bite me in the crotch!
Yeah. Do they ever get to an age where you can't roughhouse with them like this?
No. Uh-oh, it smells of quail in my pocket, I forgot. Yeah. Just to remind you that I'm not crazy. It's just the way the wolverine feels every... So you see the change in his... from the beginning to now, see how it is?
Hi! Yeah, yeah.
As we make our way around the compound, it's decidedly unimpressive. I mean, it's impressive because I know what's prowling in the various enclosures, but it's very rustic. More realistic, Crochell maintains. He recycles what he can, fencing, wood, and the like, to make large pens for the animals. They've got plenty of room to roam and run, and they're moved out to the back 40 when there aren't guests around. The novelty of Banff has worn off, so we move on. In the distance, a wolf howls. But for now, I settle for a lively young fox.
This is a very delightful little creature, Philippe, the silver fox. Every animal has its own little language. Philippe was born this spring.
And in case you're wondering what the fox does in fact say... Crochell throws Philippe some frozen quail parts. He claps and makes his fox noises to get Philippe to mug for the cameras. Crochell knows what photographers, professional or not, want. Wild Alaska animals in their natural habitat, but from the safety of a fenced-off area. After Philippe, we move on to visit Lennox, a male lynx. Crochell wrestles with the giant cat and has a bird part on a string, like a morbid version of a common house cat toy. Lennox seems relaxed and happy to interact with Crochell. The bond really is remarkable to witness.
The animals are my therapy. I don't know what I'd be like, but my personality would change, I think, if I wasn't around animals.
Lastly, we head to Isis, a 5-year-old lone female wolf. Crochell gets in her pen, and she plays like a giant husky, running and throwing herself at her master. Isis was born at Crochell's. Both her parents were orphaned in the Brooks Range, Crochell says.
Dances with wolves right here. This is what it is.
We finish the tour with a group howl. Isis eventually joins in. For AK, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Devante Owens, a student at UAA who was born and raised in Alaska.
Now, after high school, I graduated and I went to go play football in Minnesota. I came back and realized I didn't have the money for school. So then I joined the Army and trained in two different states other than Minnesota, Missouri, and Virginia, and came back. And in those three states that I ventured out, I've realized that Alaska's better. It's beautiful, the snow, I mean, the mountains, you can't really beat it. You really can't. I love snowboarding, sledding, anything to do with the snow. Going down the mountain, you know, flying 20 miles an hour, or if you got a wax board, you're going faster, but you get the wind on your back and you just, I don't know, it feels good. I guess summer, you'd say hiking. My mother likes to berry pick, so berry picking is on the list as well. anything outdoorish, I mean, you can't beat that. Only in Alaska, you can walk out the movie theater and walk straight into a bear, a big bear. I mean, just right in front of your face. Walked out of the Takotany movie theater, me and my girlfriend, and freaking, there's a bear right there. And she's like, she pushes me, and I'm looking over there, what? Why are you pushing me? Walk the other direction. So yeah, I mean, you're gonna run into bears, you're running into moose. Like, that's like, I've never run into so many animals in the other state I've been in. The one main thing that people always tell me about that they don't want to come up to Alaska because, oh, there's so much snow, it's not that bad. It really isn't. And once you experience one winter at least, just try one winter. If you don't like one winter, yeah, I'll give you that, but it's just winter, you gotta survive.
Devante Owens is a student at UAA, and 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jillian Rogers, Wesley Early, Annie Fite, and tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Every Alaskan is connected to salmon, whether living in downtown Anchorage or on the Yukon River. So this winter, join the Salmon Project as they journey across the state. Join the journey at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.